Hello, everyone, and welcome to Mini Science 2011. My name is Martin Grant, and I am still the Dean of Science at McGill University. I apologize for all. I'll try to think of new jokes, but I'll just use the same ones over and over again. This year, our series is entitled Better Living Through Chemistry? And we'll look at that from that question from both sides now. Our goal is that participants will take on the challenge of discussing the role of chemistry in daily life, and it isn't to be uncritical cheerleaders of the idea that chemistry is great or that chemistry is bad, but to take a realistic look at it. Today's speaker is one of McGill's gems, Dr. Joe Schwartz. Joe's title you can see right up here. He's professor of chemistry and the director of the McGill Office for Chemistry and Society at McGill University. His love of chemistry and science have led him to a wide variety of projects. He initiated and continues to teach an applied chemistry course called The World of Chemistry, which has the largest enrollment of any course that kids aren't having to take because it's part of their required courses on the curriculum. He conceived a unique stage show entitled The Magic of Chemistry that blends chemistry, magic, images, and music, seen by more than 100,000 people across Canada. And that will be the big punchline of mini-science this year in our seventh lecture. And Dr. Joe has lots of broadcasting experience as well, and everybody knows him quite well. Tonight we'll hear from him about his take on the good, the bad, and the worst aspects of chemicals. Now, as always in mini-science, we have a skill testing quiz. The skill testing quiz for today, as we didn't have a lecture last week, is how to find the parking in this building. And I encourage people to just drive into the mislabeled parking garage in the Bronfman, because even though it says permit holders only, as you are members, soon to be members of mini-science alum chemists, you are fully welcome to drive down there, park your car, and it's cheaper than parking on the street. Okay? I think it's $7 after 5. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And we will have feedback forms. And at the end of it, the mini-series does a kind of an interesting question-answer period. So if you could write down your questions on a piece of paper, then our trained volunteers will bring them to me, and I will sort them through on the basis of, one, their interest, and number two, their legibility, and I will read them to Dr. Joe. The ones we don't get to, either because, mostly because I can't read them, will be posted on the MiniScience website. And please complete the evaluation form so we get some idea of how well we're doing. If you've not already done so, please turn off your cell phones, Blackberries, or other devices that might disturb the audience. And with that, that's enough of me, and we move directly to the talent. Dr. Joe, it's all yours.
Thank you. Thanks, Martin. Thanks very much. Now, one day, there was a professor who stood in front of a class, very much like this one, and he held up a bottle with a live worm in it. No, this one doesn't have a live worm. And he showed it to the audience, and then he proceeded to pour some alcohol into the bottle, and the worm died. He picked up another bottle with a live worm, sprinkled in some tobacco ashes, and the worm died. Picked up a third bottle, poured in some chocolate syrup, and the worm died. At which point he looked out at the audience. He said, "What do you make of that?" And one inventive little boy in the back stood up and waved his hand and said, "Sir, if you drink, smoke, and eat chocolate, you don't have to worry about worms." Obviously, having made the right observation, but having come to the wrong conclusion. In science, of course, what we do is make observations based upon conclusions. Now, I don't have a live worm in there, but I do have a Coke bottle with a cap. So we're going to do a little experiment here with observation and conclusion. Normally the cap goes on top of the bottle, right? Not in this case. It goes right through the bottle. Is that correct? Is it through the bottle? Can it come out of there? No. So you made the observation, right? The question is, did you come to the right conclusion? You'll never know. But coming to the wrong conclusion can lead people down the wrong track. And that, of course, is what we here at McGill try to avoid. And our office, in fact, was established about 12 years ago now with exactly that in mind, to clear up confusion, to make sure that people make observations and come to the right conclusion. It is really the first time that a major institution like ours, which is ranked anywhere from, 12 to number 18 in the world, we look at number 12, it is the first time that any such institution has said that our job is not over the moment that our students leave through the rotted gates onto Sherbrooke Street, because today there's such hunger out there for scientific information that if it isn't fulfilled in a proper, unbiased fashion, then people will end up listening to whoever is standing on top of the tallest soapbox yelling the loudest. And those usually are the quacks. Oh, they may be cloaked in the garb of science, but nevertheless, quacks they are. So really our mandate is to try to demystify science, to try to make sure that people are up to date on the progress of science, to foster critical thinking, to separate sense from nonsense, and if all of that works, hopefully keep people out of the clutches of those charlatans. Well, when we started up, I thought that the office should have a logo. So we went through all kinds of machinations, and I thought that this one would be the most representative because, of course, we're not against eating meat, although we eat too much of it in North America, no. What we're against is this commodity, which is starting to be piled higher and deeper. And it is getting to be harder and harder to dig out from underneath it, mostly due to the internet, where nonsensical information is so readily transmitted. Anyway, that was my idea. The university did not go for it. But I think it is indeed quite representative. Well, as you know, my background is chemistry. And when you hear that you're going to be talked to by a chemist, several images, I'm sure, come to mind. One is, gee, this is going to be boring. Because chemistry, harken back to your high school days, not too exciting. But the fact is that it is an exciting endeavor. And hopefully I'll be able to convince you of that. Or you might think that chemists spend their time just thinking about what new cancer-causing additive they can unleash or what they can blow up. Well, we don't usually blow things up. Neither do we unleash cancer-causing additives on the public at large. But that's the image that is out there. And the word chemical, unfortunately, has become synonymous with toxin. And this is something that we obviously try to clarify. That's a real misconception. People look at acetic acid and they think that's a chemical, whereas vinegar is not. So we certainly need some enlightenment along these lines, and we try to do that especially this year because it is the International Year of Chemistry as decreed by the United Nations. That's why we have dedicated this year's mini-science to the subject of chemistry. Now, of course, the idea, as Martin said, is not to cheerlead for chemistry and say that everything about chemistry is good and great. No, that's not the idea at all. The idea is to bring some reality to the situation, hopefully coupled together with some experience and some wisdom. Because goodness knows there are skeletons in the chemical closet. No one is going to hide that. In the past, there certainly have been mistakes, but we have to look forward. We can't dwell on what was in the past. We have to take a look at what is happening today. We have to look at the world as a big collage of chemicals, because that's what it is. Chemical is not a dirty word. It is just a descriptor for the materials that make up this fascinating life that we have. What we really need to do is to examine it and understand it. Not to think of chemicals as fearsome commodities, but not to worship them either. What we need is really a dose of reality. They're not to be feared. Chemicals are to be understood. And we need to start that understanding early in life. That's when you can really capture students. That's when we can teach them critical thinking. We should spread the wisdom around. Everyone needs to learn some chemistry, because it really is the central science that ties all the others together. Because the world revolves around chemistry. Everything in the world, obviously, is made of chemicals. Indeed, Chemical Abstracts has just recorded the 50 millionth known compound. That sounds ominous to a lot of people. But we do now know over 50 million compounds. They're everywhere. They are in the cleaning agents that we use. They are in the medications that we take. They are in the dyes with which we color our clothes. They are in the clothes themselves. Of course, everything is made up of chemicals. The food that we eat is nothing more than a collage of compounds. When we go out and sniff the pine trees, that mix of terpenes that we find such a sensational smell, of course, it is just a mix of chemicals. And then there are the decisions. We make decisions all the time. They're chemical decisions. From morning to night. In the morning we get up, decide, are we going to put butter or margarine on that toast? That's a chemical decision. It's a risk analysis decision. We don't really think about it like that. But that's what it is. Because what goes through your mind? Is butter better than margarine? For what reason? Because you think of the fat content, you think what it might do to your cholesterol levels, you think what it might do to your life. Chemical decision. We decide what kind of coffee to drink. Is it going to be espresso or filtered coffee, brewed coffee? I mean, those are all different chemical processes with different chemical outcomes. But you just sniff that cup of coffee, and you're sniffing over 1,000 different compounds. Of course, all naturally occurring. Decisions everywhere. We decide what kind of fat to fry our food in. It's not an inconsequential decision. Because whether or not we use saturated fats or monounsaturated or polyunsaturated certainly does have an impact on our health. So we make these decisions all the time. We decide what to do with our garbage, how to dispose of it. That's a chemical decision, because what we're interested in is recycling, reusing materials. So all of these things come down to an understanding of chemistry. Who you go to bed with at night is becoming more and more of a chemical decision. Right? So these are all the kind of things that we think about from morning to night, but most people don't think about this as a chemical engagement. I do. I look at the world and I see it as a set of mysteries to be unraveled. Chemical mysteries, of course, and often it is very complex. If a cup of coffee can have over 1,000 different compounds in it, well, then we get a feel for how complex the world is in terms of chemistry. Well, I've been in it, this business of solving, or at least trying to solve chemical problems, for a long time. The way I got into it is kind of an interesting little story, and it's a magical story, but it's also a chemical story. And this takes me back to grade 6, when I was invited to a birthday party. And there were about a dozen of us friends sitting on the floor in my friend's living room. There was an entertainer there who was a magician. To us, he looked like an accomplished pro. He wasn't. He was a teenager, and he wasn't very good. Most of the tricks he did were eminently forgettable. But there was one that turned out to be memorable. I thought I'd share it with you. He showed us three ropes, a white one, a pink one, and a blue one. They were tied together at the top with a knot and at the bottom with a knot. Can you all see that? You want more light? too bad, you're not going to get it. So because they were tied together with a knot at the top and at the bottom, there were six ends. He told us he was going to perform a miracle. He was going to convert those six ends into two. We had no idea what on earth he was talking about. But he proceeded to undo the knot at one end of the rope, just like I'm doing here. And he tied together the white rope and the pink rope. Then he turned the whole thing around. He undid the knot at the other end. And he tied together the white rope and the blue rope. And he triumphantly showed us that he had converted the six ends to two. And he waited for the applause, which never came. Because even at that immature stage of our lives, we figured that maybe with 2-3 years of training, we could duplicate that effect. But then he did something I've never forgotten. He took those three ropes tied together with the two knots and he rolled them up in his hand, just as I'm doing here. And then he said, you know, guys, I never go anywhere without my magic chemical. He reached into his pocket to get his magic chemical, which he sprinkled on those ropes. And believe it or not, when he unraveled the ropes, the knots were gone, and he did have one rope with two ends. Oh, don't bother. That's such a simple little trick, I won't even bother telling you how it's done. But it got me interested, because he used the word magic chemical, not alakazam, hocus pocus, or abracadabra, magic chemical. I knew nothing about chemistry or magic back then, but it interested me enough to go to the school library, take out a book on chemistry, take out a book on magic, and follow both of those. And it has, of course, turned out to be an interesting and fruitful adventure. But people might think that what a strange set of events, you know, I mean, chemistry and magic, they seem dire opposites. Chemistry is a hard science based in facts. Magic is sort of an ethereal activity. I mean, what do magicians do? Magicians do the impossible. Magicians can take ropes and hypnotize them, right? They transcend the laws of nature. That's what magicians do, right? Whereas with chemistry, we're in the real world. Well, of course, a magician is just an actor playing the role of a magician on the stage. Everything that he or she does is done by perfectly explicable scientific means. Of course, the audience is not privy to those means. Well, chemistry can be like that as well, because it can indeed seem to be magical until you have the explanation. And then, of course, science replaces the magic. We don't want to hide the explanation. The real beauty of science is in revealing how things work. So that's what got me started. But there was another catalyst, and that was Barbara Eden. She starred in a classic TV show called I Dream of Jeannie. I liked that show because I liked her. Remember, this was back when I was in grade 8 or so. And what really intrigued me was the start of that show, because it began with her master finding a bottle on the beach, accidentally rubbing it, and out would emerge the genie from that bottle. I remember thinking, how did they do that? How did that smoke come out of that bottle? Well, I liked the show because I liked her. I liked the chemistry. I had visions of the future. And but, of course, it was the other type of chemistry that interested me, was how did that happen? Well, it was only when I was in graduate school that I learned about this simple chemical reaction. Hydrogen peroxide decomposes to give you water and oxygen using a catalyst, manganese dioxide. This reaction generates a great deal of heat, so much heat that the water actually boils and changes into steam. That's how the genie came out of the bottle. You want to see a genie come out of a bottle? They always do. Hydrogen peroxide, 30% is pretty nasty stuff. It is not what you buy in the pharmacy, which is 3%. Numbers matter a great deal in science. That extra zero makes this effect possible. Here's the manganese dioxide. You can see that it starts to boil right away. And here comes the genie out of the bottle. Now, of course, once you understand the chemistry, it is no longer magic, right? Now we have science in its place. So that reaction catalyzed my interest in chemistry and also turned out to be very fruitful because it allowed me to call one of my books with that title, Gene in the Bottle, where I told the story much like I told it to you here, but also it serves as a metaphor because that really is what science is all about. It is like a genie in the bottle, but you better make sure that you can control that genie. And of course, we have a tragic example of that going on right now about the benefits and the risks of nuclear energy. So chemistry really is like gene in the bottle. And then when I started to look into this, I was absolutely fascinated by the connections that could be forged using even just a simple chemical like hydrogen peroxide. Sure, it could make genies come out of the bottle, but it could do a whole lot of other things. It could protect the bombardier beetle, for example. What a fascinating little guy that is. He has a self-protecting mechanism. Whenever he is annoyed by a predator, which can be a bird or a rodent, he protects himself by unleashing a chemical weapon, a toxic spray of hydroquinone and steam. But it's all made possible by hydrogen peroxide. In a set of glands underneath his belly, he stores hydrogen peroxide and hydroquinone. When he's frightened, he squeezes his belly and another gland releases an enzyme, which is essentially doing the same thing as what my manganese dioxide did here. It allows the hydroquinone and the hydrogen peroxide to react to form steam and a compound called quinone, which is toxic to the predator. So they get this in the face, they learn to leave that little beetle alone. So there it is, hydrogen peroxide in chemical warfare, doing a great deal of good for that particular beetle. But that hydrogen peroxide can also do some harm. Let me take you back for a moment to the Second World War and the Battle of Britain. The Germans would routinely bomb London. The German planes were coming in pretty effectively. However, the Royal Air Force was doing a very, very good job against them. The reason they were doing a very good job was because they had something the Germans did not have. They had radar. Of course, radar was top secret, and they didn't want to let on that they were using radar. So British intelligence released a story that their pilots were especially talented at seeing in the dark because they were eating a lot of bilberries. And bilberries are a source of vitamin A, and that this was what was fueling the British success. Of course, the truth, it was radar. But while the Germans were out hunting for bilberries, the Brits were shooting down the Luftwaffe's planes. But the Germans, as you know, were not technologically inept. And they decided to try a different weapon. And that was the V1, or the buzz bomb, as it was called. And what a terrifying weapon that was. It was launched against targets in England, mostly from France. It was a pilotless jet plane. Essentially, it was a flying bomb. It was filled inside with explosives. It was launched from a pad like this in Europe. And here you see the V1 sitting on the launch pad. And underneath it are cylinders of hydrogen peroxide. This was a jet plane. A jet plane, of course, relies on the oxygen from the air in order to allow the combustion process to pursue. But in order to suck in enough oxygen, this vehicle had to be going fast enough. So it had to be launched off of the pad with tremendous speed. Well, that's where hydrogen peroxide came in. They would fill a chamber underneath the V1 with the peroxide. They would add the catalyst, much like I did here, and the V1 would blast off the launch pad. The engine would fire, and it would be on its way to London with terrible consequences. The V-1 had such a large payload that it could destroy city blocks. So there we go. Hydrogen peroxide, on the one hand, protects the bombardier beetle. On the other hand, it helps bomb London. It isn't good or bad. It all depends on the context of use. The Germans improved upon the technology with their Comet, which was the world's first rocket plane. This time it was piloted, but it basically was a cylinder full of hydrogen peroxide. To take off, the pilot would actually pull a lever, the catalyst would be dumped into the peroxide, and it would go off like a rocket, Newton's third law. Every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Well, it went off like a rocket because that's exactly what it was. It flew faster than any Allied bomber that was coming in to bomb Germany. It would rise above them and then dive down and pick them off like ducks. Luckily, this was developed pretty late in the war, and it only had a flying time of about 9 minutes. But the technology was pretty sophisticated. After the war, the same technology was used in the rocket belt, cylinder of hydrogen peroxide on the back. Well, the world first heard about this in a most interesting way. We heard about it in Thunderball, the fourth James Bond movie, where Sean Connery, who was James Bond, the others, of course, were actors playing the role of James Bond, in the opening scene, he flew with a rocket belt. Well, that rocket belt works on the same principle as the German Comet. Hydrogen peroxide pushed into the gas generating chamber by the inert gas nitrogen. The catalyst would be introduced. Newton's third law in action once more. Every action equals an opposite reaction, and you take off in the opposite direction. So the rocket belt, very, very effective. Of course, it does not hold a whole lot of fuel, only about 30 seconds worth, so that pilot had better be a good pilot. You want to be pretty close to the ground when that fuel runs out. But anyway, it is obviously chemistry that makes that fly. And back then, in the 1960s, when this was first introduced, indeed, chemistry was flying high. It was leading the way. You didn't have a pejorative adjective in front of the word chemical every time that it appeared in the lay press. Indeed, chemistry was in the limelight. It was a star because it was delivering all kinds of goods. It was delivering drugs. It was delivering new plastics. We had a wide range of cosmetics. Our food supply was increasing. What happened? Why did chemistry turn into the work of the devil? How did this happen over such a short period of time? Let's go back in history a little bit to the good old days. The good old days of chemistry, when people flocked to the Royal Institution of Great Britain every Friday night to hear public lectures on chemistry in the 1800s. It was a prime source of entertainment in England. Indeed, the first street that was ever made into a two-way street in London was Albemarle Street, where the Royal Institution is located. And that was because the Friday night lectures were so popular that people were coming with their carriages from both sides, and there were constant traffic jams. So they had to make it one way, because they flocked to hear lectures by people like Humphrey Davy. Here in this cartoon, the impish Davy has generated some nitrous oxide, laughing gas, which a volunteer from the audience has inhaled, with some explosive consequences. So people were entertained by chemical lectures. Of course, this was at a time when there was no radio, there was no TV. Live entertainment was the only way to go. If you wanted to hear something really great, you would go and listen to Michael Faraday, arguably the greatest scientist who ever lived in terms of the number of pots he had his fingers in and all of his discoveries. His lecture on the chemistry of the candle was absolutely magical. For 2 hours, he held the audience spellbound, discussing every feature of the candle, from the wax that was used to make it to the color of the flame. People heard about fantastic new advances in medicine. In 1850, a wonderful new substance was introduced at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston called ether. It was used to put people to sleep. Surgery, completely different after the introduction of ether. Before that time, they would carry out operations, amputations were done routinely without any anesthesia. If you can imagine what that was like. Well, ether was introduced, it completely changed the view of surgery that the public had, and of course, justifiably so. People heard about these kind of wonders. They heard about Joseph Lister in England cutting down infections in operating rooms by spraying a compound called phenol or carbolic acid into the air. Because in those days, even if you survived the pain of surgery, you were likely to die from an infection. But Lister put a stop to that. People heard about all of these wonders. They heard from Charles Goodyear how he was able to take rubber, a natural exudate of a tree, and mix it with sulfur and heat it up, and basically harness the properties of rubber, make it into a usable material. They heard about William Henry Perkin, who in an effort to try to synthesize quinine in the laboratory, accidentally came up with the world's first synthetic dye called mauve. They heard about celluloid, the world's first real plastic. It was made from cotton by treating it with nitric acid and sulfuric acid. For the first time, gentlemen could have cuffs made of celluloid and collars so that they didn't have to change their shirts. Every night they would just take off the collar, take off the cuffs, rinse it under water. Next day they would look clean and sharp. And if you didn't go too close to them, no one would know the difference. There was Bakelite, the first true plastic made from raw materials. Celluloid was also a plastic material, but its base was cellulose, which is already a polymer, a giant molecule. Find it in cotton. Bakelite, on the other hand, was made from phenol and formaldehyde, two very, very small compounds. Beautiful jewelry, radio cases, eventually TV cases could be made of Bakelite. And then, of course, in the area of medicine, chemistry played a dramatic role as well, with the introduction of drugs like penicillin, changed the course of history. Nylon was introduced. Ladies stood in line around the block in front of Macy's in New York on Nylon Day, waiting for those stockings to go on sale because they were so much better than, or at least cheaper than, the old-fashioned silk stockings. In fact, you could even buy a crayon with the nylon stocking so that you could draw a line down the back for a seam if you didn't want your neighbors to think that you were buying a cheap nylon stocking instead of an expensive silk stocking, because silk stockings always had a seam. With nylon, you didn't need it. So, of course, it became extremely popular. In 1939, it was featured at the New York World's Fair. It was one of the main exhibits at the DuPont Pavilion, where they introduced the slogan, "Better things for better living through chemistry." Nobody ever said boo about that. There was no discord. No one said, why are you promoting chemistry? Why are you unleashing toxic substances into the environment? Why are you filling our bodies with nasty things? No one said anything like that. Even in 1964, at the second New York World's Fair, and this one I can tell you from experience because I did visit there, the DuPont Pavilion still featured that slogan, and they had dancing molecules. The amphitheater, roughly about this size, where they had that show, which they put on many, many times a day, everything in that theater was made of some DuPont product. There was nylon carpeting, there were acrylic curtains, there was a polyester screen, there were celluloid items, the seats were made of synthetics, and they danced through the story of the wonders of chemistry. No one ever objected to that. There wasn't any downcast look at chemistry. The chemical bandwagon was happily rolling along. People were having fun with chemistry. You could actually go out and buy a chemistry set with real chemicals in it. You could do experiments. You can't anymore. I tried to buy a chemistry set for my granddaughter. The one I came across was this one. You can do more than 35 activities in chemistry. No chemicals required. Oh, my, my. Where we have come from better living through chemistry, where the better living is if you don't use any chemicals at all. Chemistry and chemicals have become synonymous with poisons, with toxins. They are being looked down upon. They are being targeted. The notion that we get these days is that chemicals are kind of like wolves in sheep's clothing, and eventually they will reveal their horrific and true nature. I get this kind of thing all the time, you know, on the radio. I get calls like this. Is tripolyphosphate a chemical? Now, as soon as I hear that, I know what they're really asking. What they're really asking, is this dangerous, right? Because the word chemical is synonymous with danger, toxin, and poison. In this particular case, the caller had been scared by a cleaning product. Because cleaning products, of course, are made by malicious chemists who put nasty chemicals in there. And she had been reading the list of ingredients on this, which actually is a pretty decent cleaning product, contains sodium tripolyphosphate. Leading ingredient, she wanted to know if this was a chemical. So, of course, I go through my whole song and dance and talk about the fact that everything in the world is made of chemicals. And I said, look, the reason that it is put in there is to enhance the cleaning action of the detergent, because there are some minerals present in the water, like calcium and magnesium, which normally would tie up the detergent and would make it ineffective. But by putting the phosphate in there, we can bind those minerals and allow the cleaning action to proceed. And I think she was fine with that, because if you expect to find chemicals somewhere, it's in cleaning agents. That's okay. That's where they belong. 2 weeks later, she calls me back, panic in her voice, because she had once again come across sodium tripolyphosphate, but this time on a different label. I suspect some of you might recognize this label. This is this wonder food called Kraft Dinner. So she says to me, you know, I give my son Kraft Dinner every day, which apparently was not a problem. He says, what is a cleaning agent doing in there? So I said, listen, sodium tripolyphosphate is actually a multi-talented chemical. It can do many things. Indeed, in the cleaning agent, it binds minerals, but here it's doing something else. Here it enhances water absorption by the macaroni so that you can give your son his daily requirement of Kraft Dinner as soon as he clamors for it. I'm not sure that she was happy about this, you see, because chemicals are okay in cleaning agents, but you don't want them in your food. And she probably suspected that the Kraft company, knowing that eating this product was a messy business and that it might deter some customers, had found a way to clean the kit from the inside out. Well, where do they get such views? Possibly from books like this, Consumer's Dictionary of Food Additives by Ruth Winter, a lady who has no business writing such a book, which sounds like a potentially libelous statement, right? How do I dare make it? Several reasons. Let's face it, the chance that she's in this room right now is pretty small. Furthermore, we're not in the U.S. with their litigious laws. But I think most importantly, I can back it up scientifically. If we look up phosphates used in cuticle softeners, shampoos, bubble baths, I mean, that makes sense, right, for a cleaning agent. But reading a little bit further down, also in incendiary bombs and tracer bullets. You see, now she would not only worry about her son being cleaned from the inside out, she'd worry about him bursting into flames and disappearing, but not without a trace. She makes the most fundamental of all chemical errors, confusing phosphorus with phosphate. Phosphorus is the element. Indeed, nasty. It was used in the Second World War to light up cities. It is an incendiary device. But you unite phosphorus with oxygen to form phosphate, it's a completely different story. This is like saying that we have to worry about water because it contains hydrogen and hydrogen, as we saw in the Challenger and the Hindenburg, explodes, right? So that's why she has no business writing such books and scaring people about phosphates in this case, misunderstanding the link between phosphorus and phosphate. But she's not the only one who makes such errors. Dr. Joan Gousseau, very educated person, professor of nutrition education at Columbia University. Not a slack operation, Columbia University. Well, I got onto her when I was reading a story in Time magazine. It was an interesting story about buying locally, buying organic, which of course everyone is in favor of, is motherhood and apple pie. Of course we should support the farmers in our backyard and not pay extra for long-term transportation. All of that, yes, sure. But then I was reading a bit further down, and she makes the quote, "As for butter versus margarine, I trust cows more than chemists." Well, being a chemist, I was kind of perturbed by that, because I've never considered cows to be the ultimate sort of wisdom. I thought that we chemists could compete with that, and maybe even outdo them. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, and maybe cows really are extremely smart and know all about life, but some might doubt it. Well, my pal, Joan Gousseau, of course, was worried about margarine because she was concerned about the trans fats that margarines harbored back then, which, of course, to her was a chemical concoction put in there by uncaring chemists. The wise cows, of course, produced their milk without any trans fats, which actually is not true, because trans fats also occur in nature, and milk does have some trans fats, but never mind, that's a story for another time. However, indeed, it is true that when margarines were made by hydrogenating vegetable oils, there was trans fat produced unnecessarily. It doesn't add anything nutritionally. In fact, it detracts. So a solution had to be found. Who found the solution on how to make margarine without trans fats? Well, of course, that's a chemical activity. So it was the chemist who found the way to go about this. It wasn't the cow. So I would suggest that next time that Joan Gousseau has a problem about her medication or question about nutrition or about how to take a stain out of a clothes, maybe instead of a chemist, she can consult a cow and see whether or not she gets some good advice. Well, I've been in this business for a long time. Of course, the only reason that that's evident is because you see the dial telephone there. Trying to clarify these kind of issues. And of course, it becomes more and more obvious that this is a very difficult task, because we are dealing with a public that is not particularly literate in terms of science. And many of the chemical issues are pretty difficult to get across. Then we, of course, have the image problem as well. Not long ago, after one of my shows was coming out, I go into the elevator, and there were two teenagers there. And they saw me coming out from the radio station, and one of them looks at me and he asks me this philosophical question, "Are you anybody?" Of course, I had to ponder that for a moment. But before I could give a scientific answer to this, the other friend piped up and he said, yeah, he's the chemist guy who talks about chemicals, at which point the wisdom of the original questioner really shone through. I said, "Oh yeah, when are you going to stop poisoning us?" Well, this is not a rare kind of encounter. This, unfortunately, is what we face these days. The notion that chemicals are bad, that they're poisonous. So I posed a question a bit earlier on how did this happen? Where did everything change from the 60s when we were flying high? Where do we see a demarcation point? Well, I think we do. And I think it began with Rachel Carson's classic book, which, of course, was Silent Spring. Rachel Carson was a biologist who was concerned about what at that time was truly the callous use of some pesticides. And she was concerned that using some of the pesticides would have environmental consequences, which would turn out to be very serious. This really was the beginning of the environmental movement. It was also the beginning when people began to look at chemicals in a wary way. Her main boogeyman was DDT. DDT had been just introduced in the 1940s as a new wonder chemical. Indeed, Churchill called it this excellent powder. Why? Because it changed the course of the Second World War. DDT was used on Allied troops. They hardly suffered diseases like typhoid fever. They were far, far less prone to malaria than were the Germans, because DDT, of course, killed the insects that transmit the parasite. DDT was a wonder product. The World Health Organization estimates that it saved 25 million lives. Paul Miller, in 1948, got the Nobel Prize for the discovery of DDT. DDT was the golden boy of chemicals. But it was so good that it was overused. The North American mentality, very often, is that if something is good, twice as much must be 10 times better. Well, that doesn't work in that fashion, certainly not for pesticides. It was so effective that they were using it all over the place, using much more than was necessary, promoting it beyond what the science showed. DDT wasn't the problem. The misuse of DDT was the problem. Well, because of the perception that DDT would have consequences in the environment, as Rachel Carson pointed out, it would lead to weakened eggs, so that birds that had fed on fish had built up DDT in their body would lay eggs that had less of a chance of survival. This, of course, plucked at the public's heartstrings. And because of this, DDT bans were initiated virtually around the world. Interestingly, in retrospect, when you look at the scientific literature, it is not at all clear that it was ever true that DDT had that effect on the eggshells of birds. But essentially, based upon that, despite the fact that it had saved millions and millions of lives and continued to do so, because of this perceived impact on the environment, DDT was banned. In North America, it was not a big issue because we already had better pesticides to replace it. However, the rest of the world didn't, or at least couldn't afford those improved pesticides. In Ceylon, for example, Sri Lanka, malaria had been essentially wiped out by DDT. They used to have 300,000 cases a year. DDT was banned. Within a few years, they were back to 270,000 cases of malaria a year, which is what they have now. The WHO now has reversed ground and said DDT should be used, but in a careful way. You don't just spray it all over the place. You spray it on the insides of buildings, on the walls. That's where the mosquitoes land. That's where it will have its impact. So DDT is not good or bad. It can be used in a proper, safe fashion, as is now being demonstrated in Africa. Some people targeted Rachel Carson, I think, unfairly, saying that basically she was responsible for the deaths of millions of people because she unleashed the banning of DDT. They called her irresponsible and called her worse than that, which is I think, unfair, because she really did alert us to a problem. Pesticides were not being used in the best possible way. We have learned lessons since that time. Chemical dumping was widespread. Refuse was just put into lakes and rivers. The answer to pollution was dilution. Well, we've learned that that's not the way to go. Indeed, there are skeletons in that closet. Vinyl chloride, a very widely produced chemical back in the 1940s because it is needed to make PVC, polyvinyl chloride, one of the most useful plastics. Life would be dramatically different if we did not have polyvinyl chloride. It is used to make pipes, water pipes. It's used in all kinds of laboratory equipment. It is used in furniture, I mean, all over the place. But the monomer, the raw material from which it is made, vinyl chloride, is a potent carcinogen. It causes liver cancer. In fact, an increase in the incidence of liver cancer was noted among workers in PVC factories. But this was not let on until about a decade after it was pretty clear to the companies producing PVC that this was true. So, yeah, chemicals were not always properly handled. Today, we produce a huge number of chemicals. Indeed, since the Second World War, some 80,000 different chemicals have been introduced into the environment. Not all of these, of course, are in use. We have 3,000 to 4,000 that are in common use. And you very often, of course, hear the criticism that we have released all of these substances without proper testing. Well, it depends on what one calls proper testing and to what extent you're going to go before you say that something is okay to use. We are limited. You know, today we can find trace amounts of chemicals, but we can't run an experiment to see what those trace amounts will do to one group of people over 40 years as opposed to another group who is not exposed at all. It's just not doable. So we end up making some hopefully very intelligent guesses about which chemicals to use and how to use them. But to be sure, they end up in our blood. Today, we have fantastic analytical capabilities. We can test our blood, we can test our urine. And we do indeed find that there are toxic chemicals there. Of course, the question is, in what amounts? But we can find them because we have the equipment. In fact, I always tease my analytical chemist colleagues about this, say that they really are the root of all of our problems, because today they can analyze down to parts per trillion, even lower actually, part per trillion, that's 1 second in 32,000 years. Just run your mind around that one for a second. 1 second in 32,000 years, that can be found. This is not a needle in a haystack. This is a needle in a world full of haystacks. So yes, we can find toxic chemicals, but just because they are there doesn't mean that they are wreaking havoc. But if you listen to the words of some of the activist organizations out there, like Environmental Defense, led by Rick Smith, he tells us if you can walk, talk, and breathe, you're contaminated. Canadians are exposed every day in incredibly insidious ways to harmful toxic chemicals. We are guinea pigs in a massive, uncontrolled chemical experiment, disastrous outcome of which is measured in disease and death. Well, that sounds pretty ominous, but it doesn't have any science to back it up. But it does tug at the emotional heartstrings. What is left out of that equation is how much we are exposed to. But of course, the books that are proliferating these days don't care about that. They care about selling copy. And this is what sells. The body toxic, that sells. Dangerous ingredients in all our consumer products, that sells. Toxic beauty, don't use cosmetics because there may be lead in there, or worse, parabens, or hormone-disrupting substances. This is what we see in the bookstores today. You can't even use your iPhone. Why? Because it's made of a plastic, and that plastic leaches out chemicals. And then, of course, on top of that, we have the electromagnetic radiation that comes out from there, which is going to finish us off if the chemicals don't. These are the kind of stories that make the news. Of course, scientifically, the question we ask is not, are there toxic chemicals in our body? Because, of course, the answer to that is yes. If you go to a low enough dose, you will find that everything is contaminated by everything else. The question, of course, we ask is, are the amounts found sufficient to produce some negative effects? That's not an easy question to answer, because we are exposed to potentially dangerous substances everywhere, not only in our cosmetics or in our cleaning products, in our apples too. Just take a bite out of that apple. You know what you're tasting? You're tasting a collage of chemicals. That's what you're tasting. There's over 300 compounds that have been isolated from an apple, over 300. Right? Let me point out some of them. Acetone. Now remember, we're talking about the natural building block of that apple, not additives. Acetone. Well, the last time you encountered acetone probably was on the label of your nail polish remover, right above where it says, do not drink. There it is, acetone. In the apple, toxic stuff. But maybe even worse is formaldehyde. You know what formaldehyde is? That's embalming fluid, widely used in the embalming industry. Highly toxic substance, formaldehyde. So one could say, gee, you know, every time you bite into an apple, you're getting some acetone. That's nail polish remover. That can kill you. But it's an economical way to go because you will be pre-embalmed. Of course, it is utter nonsense. The apple doesn't kill you. In fact, we tell people to eat an apple a day, more than one if they can, because the benefits of eating that apple greatly outweigh any risk caused by acetone, because we look at numbers. Numbers make the world of science go round. We always measure, we compare. We need to know numbers. And we know that the amount of acetone or formaldehyde is trivial. Similarly, we can look at things like bisphenol A, phthalates, or whatever so-called toxin one encounters, and evaluate that in terms of numbers. Paracelsus, the famed alchemist philosopher, introduced this concept over 500 years ago. It's the cornerstone of toxicology. Only the dose makes the poison. Numbers matter. What we need is a reality check when evaluating chemicals in our life. We need to look at the risk-benefit ratio, not whether something is toxic or not. There are numerous toxins in our environment. The question is, are there enough to do us harm? Life is full of risks. You cannot get away from them. You can be out for a casual walk, and terrible things can happen. Horrific things. Oh, don't worry. We staged it. They're fine. But they're not the innocent little creatures you think they are. There's a risk with everything. Unfortunately, if you look outdoors, look around you, there is no free lunch. If you are going to travel down life's highway, you have to learn to pay the tolls. We look at the benefits, we evaluate them relative to the risks. And if you look for a chemical-free life, the fact is you are not going to get a very good deal. Because the only thing you can buy that's chemical-free is a vacuum. Everything else, obviously, is made up of chemicals. There are no such things as safe substances. There are only safe ways to use substances. And we have to use our chemical knowledge to determine how to use them safely. How to overcome the barriers of life. How to live longer. That's the challenge. Well, knowledge is really the answer. To a large extent, chemical knowledge. That is what allows us to stretch out our years. And indeed, we are doing that. We are living longer. We are living better than anyone has ever lived. If you look at the statistics, the overall cancer rate per 100,000 population is remarkably steady. We had a little blip in the early 1990s. That's when new techniques were introduced, diagnostic techniques that, you know, things like MRI and prostate testing, and that also was when there was a lot of estrogen being prescribed for menopause, which, of course, eventually turned out to not be a good idea. So we had that blip, but it's pretty, as you can see, pretty level. But when it comes to life expectancy, it goes up and up and up. Well, that's in the U.S., but Canada is actually even better than that. And then we're seeing this in the rest of the Western world, too, and also in the emerging nations. So we can't be doing everything wrong with all of these chemicals that we are releasing into the environment. But whether or not the slogan of better living through chemistry will ever return is doubtful, because it has been sullied mostly by the notion that we can now detect substances which we were never able to detect before, and that we can ponder whether or not those are doing anything. But I would suggest to you that when our problems come down to worrying about whether or not a few parts per trillion of bisphenol A leach out of a plastic water bottle, that is a lot better worry than thinking about whether we're going to catch cholera or dysentery or typhoid or succumb to gonorrhea, syphilis or tuberculosis or polio. Well, chemistry, of course, has given us solutions to all of those problems. So hopefully this year, in the International Year of Chemistry, we are going to be able to explain some of these issues in greater depth. We are going to be able to turn on some students to science. But one thing we will never be able to do is answer all of the questions that arise about the use of chemicals in our life, because it is just too complicated. There are some questions that just cannot be answered no matter what we do. And when we have a lifestyle where we are exposed to hundreds of thousands of different compounds in various ways every day, it is not possible to predict the consequences of all of those actions. But I will try to answer some of your questions that perhaps have arisen because of this. But first, I want to tell you, I want to admit to a lie. I told you at the beginning that chemists don't often blow things up. It's not true. And I suspect that you probably wouldn't want to go home from a chemistry lecture like this without seeing at least one explosion. So I don't want to disappoint you, but I do want to do this in the proper scientific way, and I do want to talk about what it is that we are going to do. I have in this bottle here a little bit of water. That's all, just about this much water. I also have a chemical here called calcium carbide. Now, I know that you cannot see this. It doesn't matter at this point. Calcium carbide comes in the form of little chunks or little stones. What I propose to do is put those little bits of calcium carbide into this flask. I will then cork it. Calcium carbide reacts with water to form a gas called acetylene. Acetylene is highly combustible. So what I'm going to do then is to set fire to that acetylene. That's the proposed sequence of events. So, there we go. There's the cork. And there's our explosion. Maybe you're disappointed, right? You really wanted to see that thing go through the ceiling. Yeah. All right. Let's load it up. Real good. And wait. I didn't wait before, right? Build up the pressure. Ready? 3, 2, 1. What do you know? Instead of an explosion, we have a lamp. But we have something else. We have a point. The first explosion used up all the oxygen in the flask. Therefore, the second time, the only place where you can light it is where it comes into contact with oxygen of the air. So instead of an explosive, we have a way to light our way through the darkness. In fact, believe it or not, 100 years ago, that's the way headlights on cars functioned. We've come a long way since then. Right? But, of course, besides having a light, we have a point. And the point is that the same chemical that was used to create an explosion can be used to light our way through the darkness. That decision is not made by the chemical. That decision is made by us. It is made by knowing how to use that chemical. So that really is the message that I want to leave you with, is that chemicals are not good or bad. Knowledge can be good or bad. The more of it you have, the more likely you are to put it to a good use. So I hope that with what we've done here tonight, I've been able to unravel some of the mysteries of chemical life for you, and perhaps have prompted a few questions.
Thank you, Joe. And the fire extinguishers are located there, there. I appreciate now if people could write their questions down. And as I mentioned before, their extra marks are given for legibility on a scale of 1 through 10. Next week, We'll have a talk on March 23rd by Dr. Amir Raz. Amir's talk is entitled From the Chemistry of Chicken Soup to the Chemistry of the Brain and Behavior, which sounds cool, so that should be good as well. I have one other thing to say, Ingrid. There should be a gift. Okay. Right. I am the straight man. Okay. And thank you, Joel, for very
thank
nice.
You.
Very,
very
good. Okay. Well, this is very beautifully written, so I really appreciate that. Okay, Joe. When a bottle of water is BPA free, what does it mean?
BPA stands for bisphenol A. Bisphenol A is the chemical that has been in the news in the last couple of years, probably more than any other, because it is so widely used. It is used in the manufacture of a type of plastic called polycarbonate. Polycarbonate is used all over the place. It is used in the shield on your car's headlights. This is what your iPods are made of. This is what many laptops are made of. Hockey helmets are made of polycarbonate. The shields that policemen use, because of tremendously strong plastic. However, it can leach out small bits or small amounts of bisphenol A. Now, we're talking about the large carboys that you see sitting on top of water coolers. We're not talking about the single-serving water bottles like that one. Hold it up for a sec so that, yeah. That's not what we're talking about. That's made of a material called polyester, no connection to bisphenol A whatsoever. So it's a big 5-gallon thing that we're talking about. Now, when you feed bisphenol A to test animals in high doses, it does show hormone disruptive properties, which of course alarms us, as it should. But the amounts that leach out from water bottles are totally inconsequential. They don't approach what is fed to test animals. And furthermore, it really isn't an issue because that's not the kind of plastic that is used to make the water bottles that we're concerned about. So when it says that the bottle is BPA-free, it means that it's not made of polycarbonate. It's made of another kind of plastic, usually polyester.
Okay. This is a good one. So there's the right now there's this horrible nuclear crisis going on in Japan. And because of that, the government is passing out iodine pills to everyone. Why is that?
Potassium iodide is what they're passing out. The efficacy of that is highly questionable. It has never really been tested. But what the problem is with the leaking radiation, that some of the radiation that is released is due to radioactive iodine. In the fission reaction that goes on in the reactor, basically what happens is uranium atoms, uranium-235, are split apart into smaller pieces. And when that happens, some of the matter is converted into energy. That's where you get the energy of nuclear power. But you also get radioactive byproducts. Iodine-127 is a radioactive substance, so this is the stuff that has been released. And iodine is needed by the human body to make the thyroid hormones. We cannot live without thyroid hormones. The thyroid gland generates these. Well, in order to make the thyroid hormone, the body needs a supply of iodine because iodine is part of the thyroid hormone, which, of course, we normally get in the diet. If you don't get enough iodine in the diet, then you get goiter because the thyroid gland tries to grow in size to muscle out all of the iodine that it can from the bloodstream. The worry here is that when you inhale or ingest radioactive iodine, it will get incorporated into the thyroid gland and cause cancer of the thyroid. This is a very, very legitimate concern. In fact, we saw this in Chernobyl. There was an increase in thyroid cancer. So the idea is to give people potassium iodide to saturate the thyroid gland with iodine so that if they are exposed to radioactive iodide, they're not going to retain it. It's a very interesting chemical rationale. It has never been put to a test. We'll see what happens now.
Now we've got a test.
Yeah, we got a test.
Okay, here's another one also from the dark side of the force. Can you explain how the chemical dispersants used in the BP oil spill work and what are the long-term effects and if you know the numbers?
Yeah. The dispersants basically were detergents. And they do exactly the same thing as your detergent does in your sink when you have a greasy plate, right? Well, water is not a very good solvent for grease, and you can rinse and rinse and rinse, and it's hard to get it off. But as soon as you put on a little bit of detergent, it works. Why? Because the grease breaks down to much, much smaller little droplets. These detergent molecules, or the dispersants in that case, have two ends. One end dissolves in water. The other end of the molecule dissolves in oil. So what happens is that the detergent molecule tugs at the big piece of fatty material and breaks it down into tiny little droplets. Whether or not that was the wise thing to do in the oil spill is again a different question, because by breaking down into very, very small droplets, you actually are increasing the surface area, right? The smaller pieces are, the larger the collective surface area. Now, we know that oil doesn't dissolve in water. I mean, this is, you know, what we say all the time. It's not exactly true. Oil is hardly soluble in water, but tiny amounts of oil do dissolve in water. If you increase the surface area of those oil droplets, you are, in fact, going to dissolve more oil in water. And there are compounds present in oil, so-called aromatic hydrocarbons, which are nasty compounds. Those are known carcinogens. So it's not clear whether that was really the wise thing to do, because it did result in more dissolution of the oil, although what the tests are showing is that there are not significant amounts of dangerous compounds that dissolved.
Okay. I must compliment the author of this question on, I presume, her beautiful handwriting. How concerned should I be about the chemicals in the non-organic milk I feed my kids every day?
The non-organic milk. I guess we need to define what organic milk is. Here, of course, we're using the term organic in its perverse sense, not the way that science defines it. And in chemistry, of course, organic refers to carbon compounds. Organic chemistry is the study of carbon compounds. But in common lay language, the term organic is used to describe a type of agriculture that uses no synthetic pesticides, no synthetic fertilizers, and does not allow the use of any genetically modified organisms. So milk that comes from an organically raised cow means that the feed that cow has been given has not been treated with synthetic pesticides, no synthetic fertilizers have been used, and no growth hormone has been injected. But in Canada, that's not an issue because there's no bovine somatotropin, no bovine growth hormone used in dairy cattle at all. Whether or not this makes any difference, I think is debatable. If you look at the real chemistry of it, I think you can very quickly conclude that there's essentially no chemical difference between the organic milk and the conventional milk. I think it's you're kind of pleasing your psyche. You're giving yourself emotional comfort by going the organic milk route. I think that there are some areas where one can make a much better argument for organic, on certain fruits and vegetables where, you know, the pesticide residues may actually make a difference. But in milk, no, and certainly not in Canada, where the hormone question doesn't even arise. Another, I think, important feature to point out, that while organic agriculture does not allow the use of synthetic pesticides or fertilizers, it certainly allows the use of various kinds of pesticides as long as they are organic. For example, copper compounds and arsenic compounds are allowable in organic agriculture because they can be mined. They occur in nature. Copper sulfate, for example, is a commonly used fungicide. And frankly, I would much rather have a well-tested and tried synthetic pesticide on my fruit or vegetables than copper sulfate.
Okay, here's an interesting question, and the person need not identify themselves of having asked it, but it's clear why they asked it. What is the best chemical to kill or get rid of bed bugs?
Huh. Actually, temperature is the best way to get rid of bed bugs. You either kill them by heating them up or by cooling them down. Very, very difficult to control this problem chemically. And the problem is becoming bigger and bigger. I'm sure you've all read the horror stories, especially in New York, where, you know, even in the finest hotels, you find the bed bugs. There are several treatments that are available. The one that's most effective uses steam. They use high-pressure steam, and they basically blow your mattress with that. That will kill them. Or you can use liquid nitrogen as well. Expensive process, but that will take care of it. There are chemical modalities too. A number of chemicals are allowed for bed bugs. Probably the simplest ones are compounds called permethrins. But the success rate is not very good with those. And it's you have to seal the room. It's a big, big endeavor. Easier to replace the mattress, unfortunately.
We hope you solved your question in the audience. And what or where is a reliable source to turn to for information to confirm or dispute books or articles written by some of the pseudoscientists you mentioned? We mean, of course, in addition to your books, Joe.
I would suggest that the websites that we have are pretty good. Three of them, this one is Chemically Speaking. You can see the chemicallyspeaking.com. Then we have our office website, which is oss.mcgill.ca. And then we have another website, together with Lauren Trottier, who also, of course, helps fund this lecture series. And he's an electrical engineer, so he is into the effects of electromagnetic radiation, and there's the for that. Now, there are really a large number of excellent books out there that can demystify science. Anything written by John Emsley is excellent. He's a British writer. I would also recommend Bat Science by Ben Goldacre. Very, very good book. Dan Gardner's book, Risk, is an excellent book. The website called quackwatch.com is superb. The blog called Science-Based Medicine, all one word, Science-Based Medicine, excellent. And another blog called Respectful Insolence, written by David Gorski, an oncologist, excellent. The National Health Service in England has a very, very good website. I think it's nhs.org. Anyway, you just Google NHS, you will find it right away. So those are all really good websites.
And we'll put all those on the website for Mini Science. They'll be underneath the click-on icon for improving science by making a philanthropical contribution to the faculty, which I encourage everyone to do. Okay, Joe, that one fell a little flat, so I apologize. What are the new frontiers of chemistry, and what exciting advances can we expect in the next decade?
The major advances are going to come from an area we call green chemistry. Nothing to do with St. Paddy's Day. Green chemistry focuses on reducing the environmental impact of chemicals and of chemical processes, and using the safest possible raw materials, using the safest possible processes, etc. And of course, the question comes up of, well, gee, you know, isn't that what you should have been doing all the time? Yes, in theory, that's what we should have been doing all the time. But, you know, when you have a significant problem to solve, you don't think of the secondary problems. When you have people dying of cholera and typhoid, you want to solve the problem of drinking water. You solve it by adding chlorine to the water. Then, years later, you find that, gee, you know, when you chlorinate that water, small amounts of compounds called trihalomethanes form. which are carcinogens. I mean, you had no idea that that would happen when you solved the major problem. But now you have a smaller problem. You try to solve that. This is the way things work. Well, today we've solved a lot of major problems so that we can focus in on some of these more minor ones. So we are indeed focusing on green chemistry, focusing on trying to source raw materials from renewable resources, like corn, for example, instead of petroleum. But of course, that also introduces not only technical issues, it introduces ethical issues. The ethical issue of growing a crop that could be used for food while every 3.6 seconds somebody in the world dies from hunger, and we're using it to make plastics or to make gasoline. But this is a very, very important area. Nanotechnology, chemistry at the level of 10 to the minus 9, I mean very, very small substances, that is a very important area. And I mean, obviously, the pharmaceutical area continues to be tremendously important because, let's face it, if you don't have your health, nothing matters. You don't care what leaches out of a plastic water bottle. You don't care whether the milk is organic or conventional. So, of course, we are going to see advances in pharmaceutical products, too, mostly in the area of biologicals.
There's only time for one last question, which is my question. Could you tell us a little bit about the pros and cons, if any, of genetically modified foods?
Well, that's a doozy of a last question because we could spend weeks talking about that one. Genetically modified foods in Canada are very, very limited. The only thing that we have in Canada that's genetically modified is canola, corn, and soybeans. It's the only thing. What does it mean that they're genetically modified? There are two modalities that are being used. One is to implant a gene into the crop that makes it resistant to a herbicide called glyphosate, Roundup, you may have heard of it. The idea then is that you can spray a whole field and kill the weeds without killing the crop. Weeds, of course, are the classic enemy of the farmer. They rob the soil of nutrients. They reduce the yield. How do you get rid of them? Well, pulling them by hand is pretty difficult when you have a farm of thousands of acres. So, of course, you plow, you turn over the soil, but plowing has all kinds of problems associated with it. Yeah, you dig up the weeds, all right, but you also cause soil erosion. So now there's a lot of emphasis on what we call no-till farming, and you can do that because of genetically modified crops. You don't have to plow. You can just spray and kill the weeds. So that's a technology that works very well. It has become mainstream. About 90% of all the canola grown in Canada today is genetically modified canola. The other technology that is widely used is the implanting of a gene into crops that codes for an insecticidal protein. And this is a gene that has been isolated from a bacterium called Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT for short. This gene codes for a protein that is toxic to insects and only to insects. It is totally harmless to humans. So you put this into the crop. When an insect bites into the crop, it's killed. Humans are totally unaffected. So this has been a very, very interesting and important development. And if you want to hear a fascinating side of this, organic agriculture does not allow genetic modification, so they cannot use any crops that have the BT gene implanted in them. But believe it or not, organic farmers can buy the BT bacterium, the entire bacterium, and spray the whole bacterium over their orchards and over their fields to protect the crop the same way because it's an insecticidal substance. That's okay. You can spray the whole bacterium with its total genome containing some 30,000 genes, but when it comes to just putting one gene, the only important gene, into the crop, then no, you cannot do that. It makes no scientific sense. All right, so why is there concern? What's the downside? Well, there are some issues. For example, you get weed resistance. Eventually, the weeds do become resistant to the glyphosate. Now, this is not because of the genetic modification. This is part and parcel of, you know, any kind of such technology. If you use ordinary weed killers or ordinary pesticides, eventually weeds and pests develop resistance. The same way as we use antibiotics, eventually they lose their effect. Why? Because not all of the organisms are killed. A few survive. And those, of course, will lead to progeny, and their progeny will have inherited their survival techniques. So it's not because of genetic modification. The same thing applies to any kind of new pesticide or new herbicide. And then, of course, there's the issue of what if. What if something happens down the road that we didn't think of? That what if question is always there. The potential for genetic modification is tremendous. We have a million children who go blind in the world, blind every year, because their diet is deficient in vitamin A, because they subsist mostly on rice. Rice doesn't have beta carotene, which is the body's precursor to vitamin A. The technology is now available to make what is called golden rice, which has a gene implanted in it from corn that codes for the production of beta carotene. You give that rice to people, they will manufacture vitamin A. You reduce the blindness problem. The biggest nutritional problem in the world is iron deficiency. Millions of people suffer from iron deficiency anemia for the same reason they subsist on rice. Well, there's a protein that can be isolated from a bacterium that could be put into rice that allows it to absorb more iron from the soil. You can reduce the incidence of anemia. So these are all possibilities. Eventually, I think the technology will become widespread, but we're at an infant stage. I like to use the analogy to 1904 and the Wright brothers. If you would have been there at Kitty Hawk, watched that first flight, what would you have seen? This rickety contraption bound along for, you know, maybe 100 yards, 10 feet in the air. Not very impressive. But if you had any imagination, you knew that a principle had been demonstrated, the principle of flight, and that next week it would be 200 yards. Next year, it would be village to village, eventually city to city. You also didn't have to see a crash to envision that that could happen. Obvious, if something goes up, it might not come down the way you want it to come down, right? But you weigh the risks and benefits. This is where we are now. We have demonstrated the principle of genetic modification. We know all the things that it can do. It has to take off. We'll see. There will be crashes along the way. That's inevitable. But do we not fly because crashes occur? That's not a theory. It's not a myth. It's a fact of life. It happens. We take the chance. We weigh the risks against the benefits. Because the biggest risk in life is taking no risk at all. Then you never get anywhere.
Thanks, everyone, and we'll see you next week at Dr. Raz's talk. Thanks again, Joel.